Thank you. I'm 62, and it's a real 60 also. It's a beautiful thing. So, Erin McSweeney, share with us, if you would.
So thank you. It's a pleasure being here with such esteemed individuals and seeing all the women out there. I've been in my career 30 years now, and it's amazing to see how far women have come. Even just looking at these conferences, we never had conferences like this when I first started out. So just congratulations to all of you, like harnessing the power, like I think it was Diane or someone this morning talked about, or Marlene. You know, we've got to continue to harness the power and make some changes. So I am currently the HR, Senior Vice President of HR for EMC Corporation. So a shout out to my EMC fellows and colleagues there. I support the products and marketing organization, so there's about 12,000 employees worldwide that my team and I support. I perceive ourselves as, you know, running the people strategy for the product and marketing organization. I've been in human resources 30 years. So a little bit about my journey, you know, reflecting on my journey as I was getting ready to speak about my story. I grew up in a very traditional household, was one of five children. But my mother always instilled in my sister and I, you know, be independent, you know, be courageous, be strong. Don't let anyone ever tell you you can't be something or that you're not capable of doing something. And she told my sister and I this over and over again, and she really was my inspiration throughout my entire career. So I went to college, got out of college. I actually majored in healthcare administration. Don't ask me why, but I did. And at that point in time, the economy was such that there weren't a lot of jobs available. So back then, you know, we had typewriters and cover letters and resumes. We didn't have social media and cell phones. And, you know, so I remember cutting the ads out in the paper and sending my resume into any healthcare institution that had a job opening. And I ended up landing in, at that point in time, personnel. So that's how far HR has come. So it was pretty, you know, it was funny because I got to the job, and when I got there, I realized that job really allowed me to realize a couple of things. First of all, I did not like working in the healthcare field. I thought the culture was just not fast-paced enough. You know, it wasn't transforming enough. And secondly, I loved personnel. I loved it. I felt that it was such a profession that was clearly transforming. And at a time, it wasn't just, at that time, it was planning the holiday parties and, you know, doing administrative work. But I thought there was just something there that it could be so much more, like executive coaching and organizational development and really becoming a strategic advantage to the organization. So I thought to myself, you know, I really love this field and I really want to make something out of this field. So decided, and then also at that point in time, there were all these laws coming into play from an employment perspective. There was the Anita Hill, you know, issue going on with Clarice Thomas, sexual harassment laws. There was the ADA. There was COBRA. You name it. It was just one after another after another. And I remember reaching out to an attorney frequently because, you know, all these laws were in play and thinking, you know, if I was an attorney, you know, how much money could I actually save this company? And if I could wear two hats instead of one and work for smaller organizations, how much more of a competitive advantage will I have from a career perspective? So at that point, I decided to go back to school. It was a year out of college. Started with going back with my master's degree, and then 2 years into my master's degree, went into law school at night. So I got my law degree and master's degree at night. Because law school is very regimented at night, it was a four-year program, so I started studying, finishing my MBA through the summers and finishing my law degree throughout the school year. My mother also, at that time, unfortunately, was diagnosed with a terminal illness. But I will say, she was my inspiration. She kept saying, persevere. This is a challenging time in your life. Get through it and persevere. So it was her inspiration. It was her strength. It was her words of wisdom that got me through law school, my MBA, and her death. So... I will say HR is pretty industry agnostic, which is great because people are just people, you know, and it really doesn't matter what industry you're in. But a lot of risk taking in my life. I went to three startups that failed miserably, you know, and then finally, you know, I got to EMC, which I just think is one of the best companies ever. I've been there 9 years, but I haven't been in the same role. You know, I've had four different roles. And the best thing about EMC is they will invest in you, and they will say, what do you want to do in your career? And it's not just about you investing in yourself. It's about the company investing in you. So find a company that will invest in you, because that's really important in your career. And just a couple more takeaways as far as, you know, what I've learned over the years. You know, you need to get out of your comfort zone. Think about 30 years ago when we had typewriters, you know. I just gave up my BlackBerry a year ago. I mean, I was forced into it, shamed into it, right? But you have to get out of your comfort zone. You really do. You have to transform. Have humility. And remember, like, when you're successful, you got there because of your network. You got there because of the people that loved you, that inspired you. And help other women. Really help other women. Madeleine Albright, we're going to talk about quotes in a bit. Mm-hmm. One of our quotes is, there's a special place in hell for women that don't help women.
Women.
Yeah. Help women. Yeah. It's really important. And leverage your network, really, and nurture it, because that's how I got to where I'm. It's all through the people that supported me and loved me. And just go for it. And last but not least, you got to make mistakes, and you're going to fail. And if you don't, then you're not making decisions, and you're not making enough changes. My greatest life lessons have been through my failures and my bad mistakes. So embrace them and learn from them. But don't be afraid to make them. You know, just go for it.
Thank you, Erin. That's great. We've got two seats right here. If anybody wants to come grab a seat, don't be shy. Come on up here. Anybody, raise your hand, please, if there's a seat next to you. And anybody that wants to come on in, there are a couple of seats. Work your way in here. Most women are not shy about claiming their place. I mean, we're talking about getting a seat. This literally, let's get a seat. And we're going to switch gears a little bit because Joyce has a very different background than many of us in the corporate world and really has a different story and a different sense of risk-taking. So, Joyce, I'll turn it over to you.
My name's Joyce Maynard. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time I've worn pantyhose in a few years.
Woo! Let's give it up for Joyce! All right!
So, I'm a writer, obviously. And unlike...
Writers don't wear pantyhose?
We hang around in our yoga pants.
Okay.
We don't get out so much. And when we do, it's not usually to Silicon Valley. This is by far the best groomed crowd that I've been with for a while. I think I'm the senior member of this panel. I am 61, almost 62, which means that I was born in the year when more people were born than ever before in the United States. I am right at the center of the baby boom. And I feel as if I've done one job all my life, unlike you, Peggy. Since I was 14, which is to say 47 years ago, I've been a writer. That's the only thing I've ever been besides a babysitter. and a parent. I have pretty consistently been facing the themes and challenges of women of my generation and talking about them. I began writing for 17 magazine. I was among the beneficiaries of the advances of the women's movement. My mother, you know, we're in a room not just with this many women, but all of our mothers hover over us today. So double the number of women in this room. And our mother's stories shaped ours. And in my case, my mother was from a Russian immigrant Jewish family, very poor, struggled to get herself to college with a full scholarship and eventually to Harvard, Radcliffe it was then, got a summa cum laude, and like so many wives and mothers of the 1950s, couldn't get a job. Sold encyclopedias door to door with her Radcliffe PhD. And I was raised to have the life and career that she didn't get to have. And I went after it with a vengeance for her, really, to deliver at her feet what she deserved. So I became the part of the first class of women at Phillips Exeter Academy, a very good formerly boys prep school, and then the second class of women at Yale, full scholarship. Went off to Yale with my clippings from 17 magazine and decided I wanted to write for the New York Times. So I took a bunch of my, I was 18 years old, took a bunch of my clippings from 17, mailed them off to the editor-in-chief of the New York Times and said, I'd like to write for you. I was incidentally a girl who could not have picked up the phone and called a boy, but I could write to the editor-in-chief of the New York Times. And interestingly, he wrote back and he said, okay. And he gave me an assignment to write the only story I was equipped to write at the time, which was the story of my life, growing up in the 1960s. New York Times sent a photographer to take my picture and cut me a check for the extraordinary sum of $750. This was 1972. I was 18 years old.
$8, yeah.
And if there are a few women in this group as old as I am, and you were at college in the spring of 1972, you may remember a full-color photograph of me on the cover of the New York Times Magazine section, wearing my blue jeans, with a title whose irony escaped me totally at the time, An 18-Year-Old Looks Back on Life. And within 48 hours, my life had changed totally, and my Yale dormitory room was filled with sacks of mail, three enormous sacks with hundreds of letters, offers to go on radio, go on television, meet with publishers, meet with editors. There was even an invitation to audition for The Exorcist. Obviously, I didn't get the part. And really, all the things that my mother would have loved for herself and dreamed of for me. And within a matter of weeks, I had signed a book contract. I had a job working at the New York Times that summer in a corner office, writing editorials, crazily enough. But in among those letters was one of a very different sort from an extraordinarily famous and powerful man, a writer. I'm not going to tease and play games here, I will say that it was a letter from J.D. Salinger,
wow.
Who even then was about as reclusive as a famous person has been in that century, telling me that he liked that piece of writing, he thought I was a real writer, and he and I were soulmates. And I did the classic, very old-fashioned thing. I basically walked away from all the other things for the powerful 35 years older man who knew so much more than I to sit at his feet and try to be the person he wanted me to be. I gave up my full scholarship at Yale. I gave up my job at the New York Times. I never graduated from college. I have 1 year of college under my belt. And I went to live with Salinger, believing, as only an 18-year-old girl can, that I would be with him forever and that he was the wisest, most wonderful, and enlightened person on the planet. And when 11 months later he sent me away, just before my book was to be published, a book he deeply disapproved of my writing, because he didn't really disapprove of publishing books anymore. A month before that book was to be published, he informed me that I was an unworthy person and sent me away with two $50 bills in my hand and the instruction to clear my things out of his house. And like an 18-year-old girl, this is one of the many differences between an 18-year-old who admires a man deeply and loves him and a 61-year-old, I believed if a man told me now some of the things that he said to me that day, I would think less of the man. But when I heard those words at age 18 from the man I regarded as the wisest and most enlightened person on the planet, I thought less of myself. I did not go back to Yale. I did not go to New York City to resume the career that had just been pretty spectacularly launched for me. I moved back to New Hampshire, where I came from. I did buy a house because I had that little bit of money in my pocket from my book. And I continued to write, and I wrote. I had a little career as the voice of my generation, sort of laughable given that I was living a life very far away from what most women in my generation were living. But I did continue to write and eventually did get myself to New York City, got a job at the New York Times as a reporter at the New York Times, relaunched a second shot at my career and was doing very well until another man came along. And, you know, I've been a sucker for love. I gave up my job at the New York Times and moved back to New Hampshire to do something so politically incorrect that actually it was one of the most daring, radical things a person could do in the year 1977. I quit my great job at the New York Times to go to New Hampshire and have babies. And I don't regret that one at all. Yesterday was the 37th anniversary of the birth of the first of my three children. The children were a great success. The marriage was not. So another experience of women of my generation that I've lived is divorce and single parenthood. And single parenthood raising a family on the earnings of a freelance writer. And if you want a recipe for how to stay awake at night, try being a freelance writer with three children to feed and a mortgage to face in the morning. I carried on with my life. I wrote hundreds, probably thousands of magazine articles, a number of the favorites of which were edited by Peggy. took a really risky move, I have to say. Peggy was the editor of Red Book magazine and did a very un-Red Book thing of sending me to cover the experience of a child in the middle of the war in Kosovo. Women's magazines weren't doing things like that. And then she sent me to Africa to write about children of AIDS, another thing women's magazines weren't doing, but Peggy did. And I was lucky enough to get to report on them. There was, however, one story I never reported on through 25 years of my writing life into my 40s, and that was the story of what happened to me when I was age 18. And I continued to subscribe to the belief that it was my responsibility, obligation, to protect the secrets of the great and important man, so much more important than I, who had laid down the edict that I and nobody else should ever write about him. And I never did, although not a week of my life went by that I wouldn't be asked about Salinger. That changed in 1997 when I was 44 years old. I can tell you very quickly why it changed. My daughter turned 18, the age that I was when everything changed for me. And where once I always saw my responsibility as to protect the great and important man, when I revisited that experience through the eyes of my daughter, I felt the person who had deserved protection and not received it was the 18-year-old girl. And I wrote, I'd written numbers of books by that time, but I wrote a book that I am still probably proudest of, that is dearest to my heart, a memoir called At Home in the World. That was the real story that I hadn't told before of what happened in my growing up years. Sometimes that book is described as the book about Salinger. It's actually not the book about Salinger. It's the book about me. But he played a significant role, and I didn't leave him out. And when that book was published in the fall of 1998, I was 45 years old at the time, you could not find a national publication that did not damn and condemn not simply the book, but me personally. I one time took a podium at a literary conference, and one entire row, I wish I could say it was just men, but it was women too, got up en masse and walked out as I took the stage. I was the violator of the privacy of this pure and sanctified writer. Maureen Dowd wrote an editorial about me, criticizing me in the New York Times. And if ever there was a moment for me to jump off the bridge, that was it, the fall of 1998. But there was one writer in Time magazine to whom I owe a great debt, because he wrote a scathing review of At Home in the World, and he said, "The one good thing about At Home in the World is now that Joyce Maynard has told this sickening story, we'll never have to hear from Joyce Maynard again."
Whoa!
And that was about 7 books ago. And I haven't, you know, I wish that I could say this was purely a triumphant story. It's also, I have to say, it's important that I say this, some things have not changed. If you Google my name today, although I have published 15 books, I have participated in political campaigns and activism and the raising of children and many other things. I've created a writing workshop that are far more important in my definition of my identity. What you will see is she slept with a famous man. I'm sorry to say that if I live another 40 years, as I hope to, it will still be written in my obituary, the name of J.D. Salinger, who I last laid eyes on. Actually, I laid eyes on him very briefly at age 44 to tell him what I was going to do, but who I basically have not had a conversation with since 1973. I carried on with my life. I found that there was a second career that was very important to me. Having told a forbidden story myself at great cost to my career, great cost. I lost my publisher, I lost my agent, the books that were published after that for many years were not purchased, not reviewed by the New York Times anymore. I decided that I wanted to help women tell their stories. And my personal mission, along with continuing to carry on my own writing life, has been to teach writing, and very specifically to teach memoir. I just came back from a week-long writing workshop that I created 15 years ago in Guatemala, of all places, where I host women, not necessarily women who want to become writers, but women who have a story to tell, often a story they've never told and haven't felt they had the permission to tell. And it is my ongoing joy to help them tell it. I'll leave it to say that that I have learned that it is no longer, I was myself when I was very young, a girl who sought approval. The approval of my parents, the approval of 17 magazine, the approval of the Yale admissions committee, the approval of J.D. Salinger and the New York Times. I became a bad girl when I was 45 years old. I did the thing that I was not supposed to do. And it was the moment when I became fully grown up, strong woman. And I will never, whatever the cost, I would never undo the decision to tell the real and honest story and to help others do the same.
Thank you. That's beautiful. Whoa. All right, now I'm going, thank you, Peggy. That was, I think we could listen to you all day. I'm going to turn this over to Ramona Pearson to introduce, you have an amazing story, and I hope you'll share that with everybody here.
Thank you. It's great being here. So my story started when I was way back in high school. I was one of those kids that every teacher kicked out of the classroom. So the good thing about that, there were goods and bads, but the good thing about it was, in order to go back to school, they would make me run. So by the time I'd end up in class, I'd have run 3 hours a day. So they inadvertently turned me into a marathon runner. So I ended up getting a scholarship to go to Berkeley in pre-med at the age of 16. And while I was there, I forgot how expensive college was, so I ended up starving to death. And I had an opportunity to join the Marine Corps. The Marine Corps knocked on the door and said, hey, you have this weird gift, and this gift is in mathematics, so why don't you join the Marine Corps, and we'll transform your life for you. You'll get 3 square meals a day, and you can run all of you want. And so I just didn't know that people would be chasing me with rifles. Encouraged me to run faster. So the opportunity of that was I was the first woman in a fighter attack squadron, but I did not get to actually fly a plane and do some of the fun things or run around in the jungle with an M16. They ended up putting me into a dark room to become the first Google Earth. So I used my mathematics skills to reverse engineer where nuclear silos in Russia were so that we could reduce the kill zone from, you know, 5 million people down to 5,000 people, and, you know, every decimal point I could get, I tried to squeeze those numbers down. I continued to run for the Marine Corps, and I ended up moving on a trajectory to become a national runner. And so I was qualifying for to work towards becoming an Olympic runner. And then I went out one day, and while I was crossing a street, a man had left a bar, finished his drink, and he was going out to buy some more alcohol. And he and I crossed at the intersection at the same time. My left leg got caught in the wheel well and spun it around. My right leg got run over, and the bumper had sliced my throat open. So by the time I hit the ground, what I realized is the only thing I could remember was that, like, a grenade had gone off in my head. And I remember putting my hands down and trying to lift myself up and felt my life's blood pouring out of me. What happened at that time is a lot of innovation happened. And so as I look around this room, a lot of you are in startups or in technology companies, and a lot of you are on the cusp of taking risks to jump into startups or to invent things. And I'm here today only because of the innovators. The innovators in this room, the innovators in other places, people who had dropped out of college to go and invent heart valves or titanium knees or feet or whatever, have allowed me to be the person I am today. So everywhere I go, I always reach out because there might be that person in this room who actually saved me. What happened was some guy or woman had, for whatever reason, taken a big pin while I was laying on the ground bleeding to death and all the gore was in my mouth, opened up my airway, stuck the pin in my throat, and brought me back to life. So, and then took another pin and put it through my rib because my lungs had collapsed, and that opened up my ability for my lung to work again. And then they were doing CPR on me, kept me alive until I got to the hospital. When I landed at the hospital, I was wrapped in ice, and they put me in a drug-induced coma. I woke up 18 months later. When I woke up, imagine waking up confused. You have no idea what had happened to you, really. You're in a lot of pain. You can't see. You can't speak, and you can't walk. So what had happened is I woke up completely blind, and they had to reconstruct my throat. Before I left the hospital, I had more than 50 surgeries, and to date, I've had more than 100 and some odd surgeries, but I've, you know, who's counting at this point? I'm probably more titanium than I am bone right now. You know, it's kind of amazing. My eye socket's titanium. Most of my right jaw's titanium. Part of my throat's plastic. Most of my teeth are titanium implants or porcelain. Both my feet now are titanium. My knee's titanium. I have a cadaver tibia. My hips, heart valves. I've had pig valves, these valves, those valves. Now I have titanium valves, so it's weird to lay at night and hear this machine clunking away. But I'm here because of innovators. And so I'm always inviting people to take those risks, to jump off the cliff, not literally. But I've done that. But it is because of the innovations and the risk-taking that people take and the ability to see the future that no one else can see. Innovators can see where they're going, whereas other people can't see. And so sometimes you're drawing a future out for people and they can't see it. And they try to hold you back because they're afraid of you jumping off that cliff. But as a startup leader or somebody who can actually see where the world is moving to, you have to be willing to fly because you don't know whose life you're going to transform or save or how many lives you're going to redirect because of the innovations you're going to create. So what had happened to me after that was the hospital had given up on me. They felt like there's no way I'd ever recover again. And, you know, of course, inside I felt like a person that had been trapped. And people were making decisions for me. And no one can make that decision for you. As long as you have a mind, you need to be your own decision maker. Well, they essentially threw a dart at a board, and it landed at a senior home in Colorado. And probably the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I landed in a senior home, and imagine having 100 grandparents. Yeah, it was ridiculous. They were trying to get me pretty fat, but yeah, I was 22. So when I landed at the senior home, when I came out of my coma, I was 64 pounds. When I landed at the senior home, I gained a few pounds. I was 68 pounds. And so there were a couple of main objectives that they had. As grandparents do, They assess your needs. And then they look at all the skills. So imagine all the skills that you have in this room. Each of you have talent, you have skills, you have knowledge. But what they had that we don't have are many years of wisdom. So they all had raised children, taught kids. There were teachers, there were mayors, there were dentists, doctors, all in this place. So they took it upon themselves to personalize my learning experience. No lie. So in the day, some of them would try to teach me how to speak again and in the proper way. And they had somebody who had Alzheimer's try to teach me to write. The redundancy is fantastic. Yeah. And men are very good at humor. So men decided that they needed to teach me how to cuss like a sailor. So at night, I would learn cuss word Scrabble. So in the day, my very first words that came out of my mouth, I won't repeat, but you can imagine what they were. So moving on from there, you know, all of us have to redefine ourselves many, many times. I had to redefine my life not as a disabled person, but as a person who had new challenges. And so even though I had a lot of disabilities to get over, the senior citizens taught me that I wasn't disabled. The rest of the world wasn't abled. And so I had to invent my ways of how I was going to interact with the sighted world. And so that was what transformed my life and how I saw my life. Not me as being something that was less than, but me as someone who was going to innovate and illuminate the future for people. And it turned something on for me, where I wasn't just inventing things for myself, but I needed to invent things for the rest of the world to get caught up with me. So what ended up happening is I started to leave the senior citizens' home. They helped me recover. And they taught me to move fast and break things, much like Mark Zuckerberg before he coined that term. One day, the biggest thing I had to get over, and this was the getting over my post-traumatic stress disorder of crossing streets. Mm-hmm. One wouldn't think that would be my biggest hurdle, but it was. Crossing the street was, imagine you have to figure out what straight means and how far the street is. And if you can't see where that is or what that means, you're going to kill yourself. And so a senior citizen just said, get to the curb and go very fast once you figure out where that curve is. But first, stick the cane out there. And if a car hits it, don't cross the street. So, of course, after breaking many canes, they decided it was time for me to go to the Seeing Eye School and also the Braille Institute, where I gained the skills to be able to gain my independence. And so a lot of things that came to mind for me as I moved on into my future was the need to be an innovator, the need to always be looking forward, the need to not be defined by how people see you and how they interpret your reality, but how you are creating your own reality. And so that's how I've lived my life. And I have made a few mistakes. You know, one time when I was offered brain surgery to get my sight back in my left eye, I actually turned that down. And it wasn't fear, though the risk of not knowing who I was if they removed too much of my brain was a little bit of a concern. But it was what would happen to my seeing eye dog. My seeing eye dog was like having my body. You know, it would be like giving up my dog would be like cutting off your arm. So my seeing eye dog, when they're delivered to you, they have a 2,700-word vocabulary. You go to school and you learn how to navigate in the world around you. But the dog starts to really anticipate what your needs are. and to really understand what you're doing. And so I went on into college, even though colleges weren't letting me in. So the ADA laws weren't created at that point, and so universities were like, only 1% of the blind will ever make it into a degree, and we don't want to waste our money or time on you. And all of the professors were locking their doors to me because they didn't want to change how they taught their classrooms for many, many years. So I kept fighting, and finally I got the military behind me, who said, you know, Uncle Sam's not going to let you guys continue to block her out. So I had to change my career trajectory. I wanted to be a heart surgeon, and, you know, a lot of the colleges were like, I don't think we need a blind surgeon. So I figured being a neuroscientist was better. But I could define the surgical pathways mathematically. So who needs sight if you can do everything mathematically in your own brain? The hardest thing I had was teaching my professors how to understand mathematics tactily. So I was like, how am I going to teach them Braille? How am I going to teach them any of these things? So I got the college kids working with me, and we decided that if we created just a rubber mat with a plastic sheet over it, I could write with a pen so the professors could see and I could read with my fingers the embossing. So such simple inventions, simple ways to transform your life. The other simple thing was thinking back at the senior citizens of how they personalized their learning for me. And then thinking about all of the students who were in my cohort with me weren't learning the same way. And yet for decades, hundreds of years, we've been writing with chalk up on a chalkboard, calculations and mathematics, and most of the students in the classrooms failed, even with their vision, because not all of us learn visually. And so I became focused on how do we personalize learning. And when I talked to the professors and said, instead of writing stuff up on the board and making education too distal from me, why not ask the students to invent the solution that demonstrated the competency of learning? And that transformed how teaching and learning happened in that university. And my cohort performed more than a standard deviation better than the rest of the cohorts previous to us on our state boards. So just simple ways of addressing problems and simple ways of helping people actually acquire knowledge is how we as a community can help transform the world for women and for men and for kids. And so I kept thinking, how am I going to grow and scale the things that I've been gathering, the knowledge across time? So ultimately, I did have brain surgery. Another innovator had innovated robotic surgery, and they were able to remove a hematoma from my brain without losing too much brain. Somebody died, and I acquired their cornea, and then they reattached my retina. So I have one eye. That's why they have me on this end, because I'd knock people over on this end. But I had to redefine my life again. So I became really good at being blind. I had cognitive maps. I had a community. Everybody liked to take the blind girl rock climbing. So, you know, and I had been afraid of heights as a sighted person. You know, as sighted people, we have so many fears. As a blind person, what you can't see can't kill you. So I became really good at rock climbing and doing all kinds of activities again. But then I had to redefine myself again as a sighted person. And I lost the trace memories of what things were. So all of your memories, as you're growing up and as an adult, tend to be visual. And then imagine coming back into the world, and now you can't put a word to the things you're seeing. Mm-hmm. So I had to relearn everything. I had to relearn how to get back into a career. And my whole life, I kept going, I'm off my path. I need to hurry up and get back on my path, because I know I can see my path. And so now I had this disability of having vision. Vision plummeted me into darkness. Plummeted me. And so I had to relearn everything all over again and regain my confidence and competence in my life and relearn how to innovate again as a sighted person. And so periodically I still have a few problems, but I won't get into that. We don't have enough time. But I was able to get back into my career, and then I was working at the Palo Alto Brain Center in memory and learning, and I, you know, trying to invent ways to help people get smarter and do other things, mostly for the military, for kids who were getting shot in the head and coming back in the first Gulf War. And then I visited a school, and I was going, how are teachers assessing their kids? And then when I walked in the classroom and realized classrooms haven't transformed, they still looked like when I went to school. That's horrifying. Yeah. It's horrifying. I mean, think about it. When your kids go to school, you'd think, wow, think of all the ways in which we collaborate around learning and the ways that all of us come together to invent things, and yet our classrooms are still like me right now, sage on the stage, telling you what you need to do instead of having the kids actually invent what we all need to do.
Ramona, I think I'll take advantage of these sages on the stage right now, and we'll throw this open to questions. There, thank you so much for that story.
Unbelievable.
It was unbelievable. All of you. I mean, thank you. Here is your chance. I don't think I've been in the company of more brilliant and capable and talented women. So there's a microphone right here. I can ask questions the rest of our time. Unless you all have questions, please take advantage. And somebody throw out the first question here or think about it and stand up to the mic. Meantime, I'll take this while you're all pondering. I know nobody wants to be the first question asker. As you've heard all these different backgrounds and perspectives, what advice that is just tactical, what can I do? For people who are in far less dramatic situations, any advice you can give? Oh, you have a question?
Yeah, it sounds like you were going in the direction I was going.
Well, you ask your question then.
Well, I heard, especially from our last two, about redefining yourself, right, over and over and over again. Talk to us about the process of that, right? And I know it's easier to look back on that and say, oh, I redefined myself.
Well,
then
let me suggest, if I might, Peggy, you've got a business dedicated to every woman tells a story. How do you tell that? Thank you. How do you tell that new life story as you redefine your life?
Well, there's a wonderful quote. I think it's a John Irving quote. It's like, there is no true story that can't be improved upon. and I think that owning your story is a very important part of your trajectory in life. You know, to grow up, you have to understand your story. Not every story has a beginning, a middle, and a nice, neat ending, as we have all heard from all of our stories. And I think that owning the story and being able to incorporate the things that are not so great that happen to you, that are traumatic that happen to you, many of us are fearful of those parts of our story. I certainly have been. It's like, don't talk to me about bad news. I was raised as a WASP. You know, we don't do that in my family. So, but being able to confront it, incorporate it, and move on from it, I think is really essential. I mean, there are people who will give you advice about your personal brand, and we've all heard that before. I think it's much more important to think in terms of, you know, what is the story that I want to tell about my life? Mm-hmm. I can tell my career story in a lot of different ways. I can say I lost my job and had to leave New York. I don't talk about that because I talk about opportunities. I talk about wanting to learn. I talk about what's exciting me. So I think that's a lot of, you know, in meditation they talk about find some brightness in the mind. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what we've all talked about. It's like, how do you, when you redefine yourself, what is that little thing? What is that little piece of brightness that really excites you? And being aware of that, open to that, is an essential part of your career. People don't talk about careers that way.
I have to very quickly say that as somebody who's taught, at this point, hundreds and hundreds of women, I won't even say taught, overseen, shepherded hundreds of women, probably thousands, in the process of learning to how to tell their story. There is nothing I have ever witnessed more transformative than the act of putting the story out there, saying not simply what happened, but how it shaped you. And you will be a different person when you do it.
You've got a question.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you could all speak to how do you find your way out of a situation to get beyond a place where you may be stuck or going through a divorce or experiencing loss or having a personal physical tragedy. What is the thing that helps you find your way out if you don't know, you know, what that endpoint's going to be? Where do you find your motivation and your way to navigate out to what's ultimately going to be a better place for you in your life?
Well, perfect moment to mention the book signing following this, including my book, You Unstuck. But I'll throw it open to these ladies. How do you get unstuck from these?
You know, so many times, it has been for me the willingness to undo myself in order to recreate myself around the vision that I have for what I need to be and what I need to do. And all along my path, I've believed in radical collaboration. And in that, being able to look at people who look towards people who have knowledge and skills in those areas that I need help, like the senior citizens, who were able to actually help me out. But also more than that, the belief in your own self to be able to create your own reality. And that your reality still doesn't have to be defined by the bad things or the things that are obstacles for you. With perseverance and grit, you will get through those things. You just have to see yourself beyond it.
Thank you. We'll take one last question, then we're going to just have a final word from all of our panelists.
Great, thank you. This question's for Ramona, and it's around innovation. So I'm an incredibly creative person when it comes to problem solving, but when challenged to innovate, blank piece of paper shows up. How do you make that leap?
You know, it's interesting. Whenever I've had to innovate, I've been in a problem. Immersing yourself in a problem. I had a not-for-profit working in post-apartheid Africa, and I had to invent a way to get internet to all of these schools that didn't have electricity, and I was like, oh, that's a problem. So it was through collaboration. I called a university in the United States, and I said, you know that NSF satellite that's kind of hovering over Africa? Could you turn it a little bit? And then I stole copper wires and tried to create my own electricity. I electrocuted myself a few times. But the community really came towards helping me create the solution. And so we all broke up, and I was reading through Google on all of these things. And everybody in these communities broke up work spaces, and we invented together to solve that problem. And then even now, like, I'm undoing my own very successful platform so I can launch a consumer app in this in the next few months. And having to do that was caused because as I was trying to work in Latin America and other places where people don't have internet, I went, I have to invent a solution so that anybody can get at our product and not be caught up with just enterprise sales. Now I have to innovate a new business for our product.
Thank you. Well, I've got to say, ladies, while most of us do not have the influence or the knowledge to get a satellite turned, I hope there are lots of other points that you can take away. As I mentioned, Joyce and I will be signing books right after, and please, a round of applause for these amazing women.
Oh, I wish.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you.